Welcome to the intersection of Black culture and horticulture with your girl, Kola B. Talking. And guess what, y'all? We Black in the garden. You have arrived at the intersection of Black culture and horticulture with your girl, Kola B. Talking, hostess with the mostest of Black in the garden. Hey, Soil Cousins, it's your girl, Kola B. Talking, hostess with the mostest of the podcast. You're listening to Black in the Garden, and I appreciate you lending me your ears. I do not take that for granted ever, and we have a lot to get into, so let's get into it. We have an interview coming up with Christine Mays, illustrious artist whose wire sculpture works are on display right now, touring the country. I am very excited to share with you the story. She really eloquently and beautifully unpacked her journey. And in case you were wondering right quick who all my special guests are that are just singing along with me as I'm speaking right now, trying something different. I love the ambient sounds, but I was like, what if I just go outside and record? So I am currently recording in the great old outdoors. You would have thought that I would have done that by now, but that's another story for another time. So just in the interest of being outside in nature, loving the earth. Earth Day has come and gone, and I'll be honest with you, I wasn't excited about it. I was actually very apathetic about it because I feel weary. I feel kind of worn out in the way that many people feel who are very adamant about doing our part to take care of the earth and to be responsible citizens and be respectful and really honor the planet that we live on. You would think that would come naturally, but unfortunately not so much. So it's still Earth Month. There are so many celebrations and observations and festivals and the like. You hear sirens, so that means there's always drama, but but Earth Month, that's interesting timing, because in speaking to the weariness, recently it came to my attention that when Alan Bruce burned himself to death to raise awareness for the seriousness of the climate crisis, and there was not much said about that sacrifice that he made. He sacrificed himself. I'm not getting into the Buddhism of it and suicide. That is not what I'm here for. That's not what the show is about. But I do want to at least recognize him as someone who identifies as a fellow environmentalist. I want to recognize him. I don't want to say too much about it. I actually have a bonus episode coming out with my co-host Derek about how I've been interpreting Earth Month and what's really necessary, you know. And I do want to close on a hopeful note when I get to that, so just stay tuned for that episode. But RIP to when Alan Bruce literally truly about that save the earth life and really sacrifice himself ultimately, and I don't think that is worth ignoring. So just worth mentioning, I am not currently gardening. I am in a very transitional place in my life right now between Nashville, Tennessee and Atlanta, Georgia, and really just trying to get my bearings. My divorce is official as of January of this year, and I am very happy to let y'all know that. Not in a, hey y'all, I'm single, check me out kind of way, because I could care less. But unfortunately, and I've said this before on Black in the Garden, women after divorce, especially women with children, tend to get the short end of the stick. And I am grappling with the short end of that stick. And one of the ways that I am being impacted by that is I don't have access to space to garden in the way that I truly wish to garden right now. But don't feel sorry for me.
because what's happening with Black in the Garden, being the garden media entity that it is, celebrating the past, present, and future of Black people with plants and gardening. And I know if you're listening to the sound of my voice right now, you're rooting for me, and I appreciate that. I appreciate all the love and all the support, but I'm just keeping it all the way funky with you, getting things together, scaling the business, the brand, planting trees all over the country. So far, we planted 3 trees for the Underground Arborist nonprofit organization that I started in January. So I have definitely been doing plant and earth things, but I still have not gotten all the way back into the soil with gardening. However, those of you who are gardening or tending to plants in whatever way that you're doing so, I'm excited for you. I'm happy to know that you're able to do it. I want to know more about it. I want you to text me at 833-819-3926. That number is in the episode notes as well. But I want to know more about what y'all have going on with your plants and your gardens and your seeds. And if you haven't planted your seeds right now, I just want to encourage you. It's not too late. It's never too late to plant a seed. You're not ever really truly late, you know, still worth a try. Maybe it's not going to come out the way you want it to, but you get to learn something, right? There's no failures in the garden is what I maintain, but I cannot wait to get back in the soil, just doing all the things as this is a full-time business for me. This is definitely my livelihood. And so because of that, there's a lot of work that I need to do to literally tend to this garden of Black in the Garden business, because that is what it has become, and it's going to be great. You've seen what we've been able to accomplish in the little over 2 years that Black in the Garden has been in existence. So y'all feel me, y'all understand my OG, my triple OG soil cousins, y'all know who y'all are. Y'all know that there's been so much growth happening here. So look, what I am doing right now in making sure that Cola be talking in very official ways and certainly getting paid for that, because business got to be done, right? But currently I am getting ready for speaking engagements that are coming up. I'm speaking at the Black Pod Fest conference that's on May 28th in Atlanta. And I am also going to be speaking at the American Public Gardens Association conference. I'll be a panelist there in June. I'm going to be providing official press coverage also in June at another event that you may have heard of, the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society Flower Show. And I'll be seeing a botanical Black history figure in person. I cannot wait, y'all. I will be speaking and providing press coverage as Black in the Garden, as the official plant media entity that it is. And I'm proud of me for being able to do all the things that I've been able to do thus far. Look, if you are ready to book me to speak, I'm ready to speak. All right. So my email address is in the episode notes. Send me an email. It doesn't have to be a large group. I love large groups. I ain't scared. You know, I'll say the things. Talking about the past, present, and history of Black people with plants. And talking about things that are all falling under that umbrella, which is so many. Take a look back through my episode catalog and take note of all of the themes that we've explored on Black in the Garden, and understand that I got the range. So I would be happy to come and speak at your organization, at your academic institution, right? I would be happy to come and speak at your garden club. I love to speak to the kids, workshops, all that other kind of stuff. Let's get creative. Let's figure out how I can come and really get it popping for you. Because one thing that you ought to know from listening to me, if you've listened to me for a while, is that it's not going to be boring. We're going to have a good time sharing all of these things. I have the range to share. All right. Another opportunity that I want to present to you all before we get into the interview. I got to let y'all know what's good and all of that. We have the Black in the Garden coloring experience, which has been featured in the LA Times holiday gift guide last year. And we're really proud of that. You know, we're going to brag about it. But we've sold over 1,000 copies of the Black in the Garden coloring experience. Go ahead and get yours. The experience is connected to having the ability to listen to the podcast while coloring in the coloring experience and coloring some of the guests. So you ought to want to do that. But if you are a shop owner, or you know a shop owner, or someone in a school system, a library system, or a place where there are groups of young people especially, but also elderly people, hospitals, we want to assist you with getting the Black in the Garden coloring experience into that group. We want to consider how to get sponsored books donated. Definitely know that it'd be worth letting my soil cousins know about that effort so that you can let me know how you can take part in getting the coloring experience out. And if you do own a shop or you have shelves that you need to put something really beautiful and amazing on, the Black in the Garden coloring experience is available for wholesale. The link is in the episode notes, but send me an email if you understand what I'm putting down about getting the Black in the Garden coloring experience into your classroom, into your group home, into your detention center or children's hospital or something like that. I wish that people wouldn't be rude and crank up their cars while I'm trying to do my podcast, but the show must go on. So, so also two more things, and then we are getting into the episode. The Plant People and Plant Places podcast is hosted by my dear friend, Maylin Plummer, our soil cousin, Maylin Plummer, who is a force in the horticultural field. And she hosts this podcast where she has these very organic conversations. Sometimes you'll hear like this ambient kind of birds chirping in the background. I was inspired by her actually when I said, let me record outside. So I was the guest on her last episode, and it'll be indicated in the episode notes that you can find that podcast. Wherever you're listening now, you can find Plant People and Plant Places podcast hosted by Maylin Plummer. Now, lastly, speaking of podcasting and podcasts, you can also hear me on another podcast, Unpacking Atlanta. Y'all, I had to go ahead and do the most and start another podcast. Fight me, I don't care. I really love the FX show Atlanta. Season 3 just started and I just couldn't help myself. I had to have conversations about it and really unpack it. That's why it's called Unpacking Atlanta. Just rudeness. Unpacking Atlanta is currently on the same podcatcher that you're listening right now. If you're into it, it is full of spoilers. So, you know, don't listen if you haven't watched, but definitely do listen along with my co-host, Sunita, one of the smartest people that I know, great writer, amazing mom. I actually shouted her out last year on our Mother's Day episode. Yeah, so Unpacking Atlanta about the FX show Atlanta. And that is everything that I need you to know before we get into this episode of Black in the Garden. Wow, we covered a lot, didn't we? We unpacked a lot just before we even got into this. And spring is springing. Summer will be upon us very soon. And stay tuned for a bonus episode about Earth Day, month, whatever, blah. As far as I'm concerned, truly, I wish I wasn't weary, but I'm not going to perform excitement when I'm not truly excited. I'll be excited if it was an Earth decade, but I ain't gonna hold you. Thank y'all for tuning in as you've been doing. Make sure you share, make sure you rate the podcast, rate Black in the Garden. Just got a new rating, by the way. I'm going to stop and make sure that I shout you out. Sahara Siren said, this show is everything that I never knew I needed. Kola brings on amazing guests and covers a variety of plant and garden topics. I always learn something new while cutting up with my soil cousins. 5 stars. Cacklin in the Garden is the name of that review, as she put it on Apple Podcasts. And I really appreciate having that acknowledgement. I hope that you enjoyed this episode with Christine Mays. Amazing story, amazing talent, amazing individual, Black woman whose art was most recently displayed at Atlanta Botanical Garden, our proud sponsor of season 5 of Black in the Garden podcast. So I'll talk to y'all on the next episode. Enjoy. Hey, Soil Cousins, welcome to yet another interview with yet another fantastic subject here on Black in the Garden, where on this episode, we are exploring the themes of how plants and creativity, or just like gardens and creativity, intersect. And what better way than to have a conversation with an esteemed artist? We're talking with Christine Mays, who is a sculptor and a San Francisco native. And as for the rest, we're going to get into all of it. Thank you for joining me, Christine.
Thank you. I'm so excited. I think this is going to be a good time.
I have a good reason to believe that that is true, because you're here with me.
I think so.
Good times is my forte. You know what I mean?
So automatic party.
It's automatic party. Let's get right into it. San Francisco native, right? When I say sculptor, let's start with this. What is the common perception of a sculptor?
Oh, wow. The common thought around sculpting is that it's that I'm chiseling something out of granite, or that mm-hmm. I'm working with clay, mm-hmm. building something, or and then with that is all the perception that it's like some sort of unobtainable thing, or that I'm like some super serious, like studious, you know.
fun.
Almost removed from the people, because I'm sculpting, you know. So there's that too.
Very important to unpack these. Christine Mays sculptures, not what you would stereotypically expect if you are thinking along the lines of what she just described, with what is the kind of prototype in the minds for what sculpture is. Christine, your sculptures, particularly the ones that have received the most acclaim, especially as of recently, are wire sculptures, where your sculptures, I feel like I'm saying it wrong. Help me with my language, Jesus.
Where I'm sculpting.
So wire sculpting these wire forms, right? And right. They are currently on display and have been touring public gardens. So there's this brilliant intersection that I just have been so thrilled to share with you all, as far as what Christine does in the public gardens, with actually being able to display her art there. And currently, is this the longest running, or like the most current?
It is. It's the longest running.
Rich Soil. The longest running.
Running set of sculptures. It's the biggest solo show I've ever created. Mm-hmm. So it's the largest amount of pieces together, and it's also the longest running, and it's now on its third location, and there's another two that are in the works.
Another two. Yeah. Another exhibit, as in a whole new set of pieces, or?
No, as in like it'll tour to 2 more cities.
Ooh.
Yes.
That is very exciting. We're going to unpack all of that. Congratulations on that. This is your longest running. Let's get into your history as an artist, and let's go back to the beginning of, because we're going to get into all the sculptures and how you got to where you're at. But the best thing about talking to the people is to get to know the people, especially creatives, because, and I'm going to tell y'all why. Let me just unpack this for myself right quick. Some of us may, because the way that the world is structured and the way that expectations are set upon us, depending on your upbringing or whatever, we may not feel that we can identify with being a creator or a creative individual
because we are more so prompted into doing traditional things, like, you know, just get you a good old 9-to-5 and don't worry about making things and sculpting things and creating things. That's not important. That is not significant enough to change the world, not even knowing what your gift may be, gifts may be. And for myself, I just know that it was well into adulthood before I felt like I could identify as a creative individual. And that was frustrating because it definitely invalidated a large part of my youth by me having very specific moments when I remember thinking, I'm not special because I don't sing like all the girls in SWV. Really just one though, because
there really was just one.
Don't get me started. But I could sing like Lauryn Hill, who Christine does have a connection to. So I wasn't singing, I wasn't doing all the fancy dancing. I certainly was nobody's athlete. And so I just did not feel like whatever it was, even though I knew I was intelligent, I did not feel like what I had to offer to the world was special or valuable, or, you know, when it came time to make that decision that we're led into making as young adults about what are you going to do with the rest of your life? I'm just like, I don't know, like live or whatever. So saying all that to say, for those who need to hear this part, I'm hoping that if you don't get some kind of inspiration, if that's what you need, that you will be able to see youth and to see the children that are in your life in a different way that gives them permission to really be creative. Do you see why I made that disclaimer?
Yeah, I do.
Let's get into it. So I just remember you were telling me about some of the influences in your childhood that were most remarkable to make you feel normalized in your desire to create. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, I was born and raised in San Francisco, so I'm definitely a city kid. And grew up in a low-income area, in a low-income house, household.
Understood, yeah.
And so a lot of my creative inspiration was just through, I mean, I always loved artwork. And so it was a given, like, you know, my mom kept us with crayons and coloring books. Mm-hmm. And that was like, even to this day, I talk about how for Christmas and Easter, we got new boxes of crayons and how that was something I looked forward to.
It's very endearing.
And, you know, for Christmas, if it was the 64 pack of crayons, it was just like, woo!
We going to town with these coloring books.
And so it was, you know, because I really loved creating and making things, I pretty much had to make, I mean, because that was the drive to do that, I would have to use whatever was around, whatever I had. Mm. It wasn't like we could go out and buy art supplies necessarily, other than like construction paper and crayons and Elmer's glue. So I would
do a lot with that.
Experiment. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just experimented with things and, you know, made things out of other, you know, like at one point I remember, this is so random, but I kept taking apart sponge rollers.
Oh.
My mom had sponge rollers for us to, you know, so if my hair was, if she was going to curl it, she'd press it with the hot comb and then she'd put the sponge rollers in it.
And the bangs?
I would take the sponge rollers apart and try to make little things out of it.
And, that sounds like a recipe for trouble in a Black home household. Yeah,
exactly.
Come on now, you taking the sponge rollers apart, baby. I just bought these sponge rolls.
Yeah, she'd be like, why is it only half the pack left? Like, I don't know, where did the other ones go? Mm. And I'd just be like,
Was it the pink ones?
It was the pink ones.
Yes. Oh my god. I would like on point.
I would take those apart and just make, I don't even know what I was doing with it. I just was experimenting. And so
that was
then,
a calling. I just see that as a calling. I love that, to know that, you know, when children are left to their own devices, what they do, it seems pure to consider, like, you know, especially when it's a creative thing.
Yeah, it was just, you know, a lot of experimentation. And then there were these little craft books books that I would always pick out. Like one thing that my mom always did was, you know, and I'm dating myself. I'm in my early 50s, but when we'd go to school, they'd have those book order forms where you could buy the books, and they give you the little form, your little book fair every week. And, you know, she would make that a priority. So even if we didn't have the money for it, like I can remember my mom rolling pennies to come up with with enough for us to have of the books each week. So we could pick out whatever. We each got like one or two books every time they did that. I think it was like once or twice a month. And she would just find a way to come up with the money for it. And so I would pick these craft books, and then, which was almost, I mean, I'm sure it drove her nuts at some point, because then when I'd get the book, I'd want to try out all of these projects. And so she would come up with like, you know, well, if we can get the supplies for it, then you can do the project. And there was a lot of experiments that failed in these projects, and she never put much on it. Like if it failed, she would just say like, okay, that didn't work. Like, clean this mess up. And so really the only requirement was just clean up your mess. And then, you know, it would just be like, it's a new day. Yes. You know, if it works, then, you know, congratulations. There wasn't a lot of like, oh, you failed. It was just, well, that didn't work. We know that didn't work. Let's try another.
That's not going to work. That Elmer's glue wasn't holding it together. We're going to have to maybe try another glue.
Right.
Or something like that. That's positive to know that she was encouraging you in that way by indicating that, like, because from your description of it as an adult at the age that you're at now, it doesn't sound like there was any tension, like any, no, I don't want you doing this. I don't want you making that mess in the first place. It's just, okay, right. I recognize that this is a process that could get messy. And so I require that you take care of that if you're going to create it.
Right. Process. Yeah. I mean, there was tension at some point with following my artistic development. And that was just, you know, after high school, it was like, what are you going to do for work?
Oh,
you know, it was like, that's nice question. And all, but
yeah,
you know, being an artist was not an idea of my life.
It was like,
what are you going to pursue to make some money and get a, you know, not even so much have a career, but just have an income to sustain yourself
and take care of yourself. Yeah.
Right.
Because was her goal for you to like move out as soon as you could? Because you know, every parent is a little different. So what was your parent like?
No, it was more just to be independent. Our income was so tight. Like when I was in high school, I had a job. And it was, you know, when I came up on like senior year of high school, I picked the activities to, you know, how they had all those, like, you're graduating, like, go to this and do this. And, you know, it was, I picked them based on like what I could afford from my after school job. You know, prom stuff was like based on what I could afford from my after school job.
Because
we just didn't have it. You know, I kind of would laugh when kids would say, like, my parents wanted to teach me a lesson about responsibilities. And I was like, well, we just didn't have it. So
you just didn't have it. You had to work. You had to actually work
for it. You know, it would just be like, you're staying at home.
Yeah.
So a lot of her thing wasn't so much like the pressure to be a certain person or do something in particular. It was just how will you be a responsible adult who can pay their bills?
Absolutely.
So it was that kind of thing.
Did you have any examples that you could look to as, hey, this is an artist that has done it? Or I remember you mentioned some of the TV shows that you would watch. Did they depict people living that life?
Yes. As a child, you know, I wanted to be an artist when I saw Good Times. And I was looking at Willona, their neighbor,
Yes, Willona.
Boutique. And I was like, oh, she gets to, she dresses these mannequins. It's like she's dressing big dolls. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then I looked at the show Bewitched, which was like this couple, and the wife was a witch, and the husband he worked at an advertising firm. And so on the show, they would show him going to work and he'd have these big storyboards. And I was like, wow, he gets to color for a living. Like he's making these pictures.
Yeah. That's interesting how I'm not sure that those shows were putting these people in these positions to give children a glimpse into that lifestyle. But I like the way that you made those connections there, especially with seeing someone like Willona dressing the mannequins and interpreting that as like, ooh, that is something that I could do. That sounds fun. That's like the child in me sees a grown-up doing something like that, that feels like play. So how do I get to where she's at? So
it's like, you know, I was excited about JJ and, you know,
of course,
seeing his paintings, but they didn't show him like working, like, you know, whereas in my head, it was like, how's he making a living off of this?
How is he even affording the paint?
Right. So I think that's why I didn't necessarily think of like him just dead, you know, right away, like, oh, I want to be like JJ, because it was like he didn't really, they didn't show him making it as a, you know, full blown adult.
Okay, so let's go there. So do you at this point, especially considering what's happening in your journey as an artist right now, do you consider, this is a yes or no question, do you consider yourself successful? And give yourself grace.
I'd say yes.
You're paying the bills with your art, right?
Yeah, I would
say. Period. The reason why I asked you that is because I want to make this connection between how you went from coming up in this household that you did with limited resources, having an understanding that as you progress into adulthood, that the requirement, if you want to do this little art thing, I'm just talking like the Black moments we talk, you want to do this little art thing, then you better make sure that you can make it so that you can sustain yourself. You pay for your own toilet paper, pay your own rent, get out my house. So what was that journey like for you? Was it linear? Was it non-linear? Was it full of like
it was so long
intrigue?
It would be like, there's a meme on Instagram where they show like what people think life is like, and they show point A to point B, and then they just show another side of it where it's just scribbles. It's just one big scribble, you know?
Yes. And that,
my life is the scribble. Like,
it's very well said.
All over the place. So
wow, tell us about some of the highs and lows. Like, was there a point, let's start with the lows, was there a point when you were like, I'm quitting this shit, I'm gonna go and push some buttons over at IBM or something?
Well, to be honest, I never thought I would actually be a full-time artist. I thought that was just sort of, that would have been like the ultimate dream, but it's not like I said like, I'm gonna do this. It wasn't like I was 18 saying I'm gonna do this and become an artist. So after high school, I went to City College, and I went to this college prep school. So that had a lot of pressure. And frankly, I only went because I got in. It wasn't because I was like, it wasn't because I had this aspiration to go to Ivy League college. It was just that I got in and you know,
that's
my mom,
good enough.
This is too good of an opportunity to pass by. But once I was there, the pressure was on to like be the best and be the highest in your class, blah, blah, blah. And
did that have anything to do with being the Black woman in the class, or the Black girl in the class full of a lot of white kids?
No, it was just the culture. And I think if I had a kid, I would not send them there. Like, it was college prep. Frankly, the school was like 80% Asian.
Oh, that sounds like even more pressure, because I understand
it's like that high stakes for everything. And so
that's a lot of tension.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got in, my mom was like, you know, I was like, I was actually disappointed. I wanted to go to the School of the Arts. At the time I was playing the viola, which is like, you know, has more alto tones. It looks like a violin, but has a deeper sound to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I get this acceptance letter and I'm like, how did I get this? I didn't even apply for the school.
Yeah, who applied?
The counselor at the school was like, oh, her grades are great. Let me submit them.
Oh, and so, wow. Look at that.
You know, I came home to my mom all excited, like, you got in. And I'm like, I didn't even want this.
I did not apply. Did you feel tension there between you and your mom at any point for having kind of made that decision for you? Or that was a decision that was certainly not made.
That was not made for me.
With you in mind, but it was made for you.
Right. So she just said, like, you know, with the School of the Arts, you could apply every year, you know. And with the other school, you had to accept it or it was just the opportunity was gone.
Oh.
Like you couldn't, no one transferred in there. It was just, you get in as a freshman and you graduate as a senior.
Mm.
So she said, well, just go in and, you know, try it for the first year. If you don't like it, then you can go to the School of the Arts. But what we didn't know is it was like it was a culture of, if you leave this school, you have failed. It was kind of like when they go to like the Naval Academy, they say you couldn't hack it, so this person dropped out because they couldn't hack it, you know. So there was that feeling like you couldn't give up because
you're flunking out, essentially. And what ridiculous pressure is that to put on anybody in a situation where it's like, I'm making a decision. How y'all feel about it is y'all business, really. Right. But I remember being around kids that came from a college prep school, and because I didn't go, and I was pretty much glad that I didn't, because I was just like, oh yeah, there's prestige here, but there's also all the work that comes with that prestige, which is your ass got to work harder. And I'm just like, high school is bad enough because we have to wake up super early every day. So let's just keep this simple as possible. I know I had the aptitude and the ability to go and perform at a gifted school or whatever, but I would hear in the AP classes in the high school that I went to, the way that people were referred to that came from the college prep school as like, oh, what you doing over here with us dummies? Not that we was dumb, but you get what I'm saying? It's like, why are you not over there if you're so smart in a regular school, but you could have been at the other school. So obviously you couldn't cut it. So it's like, it's interesting how that works within the walls of that school. Mm-hmm. It's also a stigma that is applied when you leave.
Right. So
yeah.
Well, I stayed. There were only a handful of people who'd left. And even to this day, they know who left.
They're petty for that.
But all that said, I just kind of floundered through high school and went from like being a kid who didn't think about schoolwork because it was so easy to suddenly, like, you know, constantly stressed out about whether or not I could pass a class. And and it wasn't like stressed out about getting an A. It was like stressed out about like getting a C.
Wow.
And
that's,
you know,
a lot of stress.
Yeah,
and that doesn't feel like the organic way that an artist would want to live their life. Did you identify as creative or artist then?
Just slightly. I mean, I had a sketchbook in high school, and I think I only took one art class in high school, and the rest was all like, you know, just straight academics. Up. When I left there, I went to City College, and my grade point average was just like a 2.0. It was not enough to qualify for even like the state schools. And so as far as the perception with the school and the counselors there, I was perceived as a flunky in essence, because I didn't fit that. You know, they're looking at kids who are going to Ivy League schools, and, you know, the people who were being praised were taking, you know, multiple AP classes in their last year of school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't doing any of that. So I went to City College and I was just, I had to spend like a year or so regaining my own self-esteem, like building it back up, because I was looking at myself as like this failure and feeling really dumb, like, oh, I thought I was really smart, but I guess not, because I didn't do good. And you know, so it was that kind of thing. And then when I went to City College and I was around like people who were just living and performing under regular conditions. And I was like, okay, I am normal. Like,
there's nothing wrong with me.
Like, there's really nothing wrong with me.
Yeah.
So it took about a year. And then at that point, I was in City College. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know really why I was there, other than I knew I wanted to go to college. And so with that,
It sounds more like you thought you were supposed to go. Maybe.
I think so. Like,
yeah,
because I just floundered. Like I would.
Yeah.
Classes, I drop a mid semester. I was just like, I floundered for years of like signing up for classes and then dropping and then signing up and dropping. And it wasn't because I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
You know, I would be doing well in the class. And then all of a sudden I'd be like, why am I even here? Like,
it's an important distinction to make. It was important for me to distinguish between you saying, I thought that I was supposed to be there, between you more realistically thinking that you were, you know, it kind of getting scammed into it. Because once again, going back to what I indicated earlier about the societal norms of it all, meaning that, you know, you are expected to do this thing and you feel enough pressure over this expectation to actually feel bad about yourself when you get into that position and you're like, this doesn't feel right. I'm not excited about this, you know? And I indicate these things because I'm talking to you as an artist, and that is at the forefront of why we're having this conversation, is to really unpack that identity. Because I don't see this being spoke to enough, especially knowing that not only are you a Black woman, but you are a Black woman who grew up in a household with limited resources and limited means. So in many Black households like that, there is not this feeling of I can be an artist one day.
Right.
And feel like I'm successful or like actually take care of myself. So I just had to make that very clear.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, and even coming back around to that, you know, I was at City College. At times I didn't have the money for all the books needed. Mm-hmm. And so they would keep like a reserve of two or three copies of each book in the library. So if you didn't have the money for the books, you could go to the library and then hope that you get that book that someone else, because all you could do is sit there and read it at the library.
Absolutely.
So, a few times I did that and people were reading the book that I needed to read. So I just was like, okay, I'll wait it out. And so in that period of time, I started looking at these art magazines that I had never seen before. And it was like all the, you know, like Art Forum and Art News magazine, which are like two of the leading, I think Art News is like one of the leading art world magazines. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at these magazines and I'm like, oh, what is this? Like, I've never seen this. And, you know, mind you, like I said, I'm a inner city kid. I don't have any kind of art history background at this point. I'm just looking at these magazines. And that's when I started seeing people who were like my age, who were making art. And Kara Walker is a Black woman artist who makes these paper silhouettes that are in like some of the biggest major museums. And at the time she had won like a really big award. And I think she'd been given the Genius Grant, the MacArthur Award. And
that sounds like good money.
And so she, you know, I'm reading this article and then I look and she was the same age as I am. So I was like, whoa, like she can do, if she can do this, I can do this.
Right.
And so that was one of the big, you know, seeds that were planted mm-hmm. as far as like, I could probably really do this. Like,
wow.
You know, and then there was like a guy who lived here in San Francisco and he was in this local paper and it was like one to watch. And I don't even necessarily like his work. It's just that he was, you know, he lived here in San Francisco and he was making work mm-hmm. that I saw as like newsworthy. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, like those were the seeds that were planted that were like, I could do this.
Yeah.
This isn't necessarily impossible. Mm-hmm. And so I went for years just dropping out, taking classes, dropping out.
Try it.
And then in the meantime, I just kept my sketchbook and continued to draw and to experiment with other stuff. And it wasn't until I was 23 or 24 that mm-hmm. I did a show at a cafe where I was showing drawings. And mm-hmm. and that was like my first art show. And then I'm still working at like, you know, all these random jobs, like working at a clothing store or working mm-hmm. working at a cafe or working at a pizza parlor, mm-hmm. you know, all those different combinations of just random jobs and then still, you know, making things here and there. And so,
yeah, you got to hustle. Yeah. I mean, the thing that anybody who does art like professionally or even full time, and I'm using air quotes because it's just like, it doesn't even really matter what the art form is. If you can sustain yourself off of it, that is a pretty big deal to be able to say that. And I'm not trying to say that an artist that makes a living off their art is better than one who doesn't, but it requires, how do I put this? It requires organization, right? It requires right. maybe even some luck. But it certainly requires a lot of consistently trying, and I'm imagine being told no and things like that. So, you know,
right.
You're putting a product out essentially as a creative product. It is customized that you create it, but it's not a small feat. It's yeah. very admirable to consider how you're able to at least be in that position, knowing like I'm sure that there was some kind of economic discomfort, but the struggle in like internally, emotionally, what you had to go through in order to figure out, what am I doing with myself? That doesn't feel good to not know.
Right. And I think the struggle, the biggest struggle at the time was, you know, well, first of all, I want to say this. First of all, being an artist really has nothing to do with making money off of it, because there's so many people who make beautiful things. They yes. never sell it. You know, they either share it with friends and family or they may share it with the world, but they don't necessarily have to sell it to be known as an artist. For a long time, I questioned like, am I an artist? You know, and then it was like, I've come to know that if you're an artist and you're a creative, you just are. It's capitalism that makes us think we have to make money off of it. So there's that's that.
Like the struggle when you're trying right. to figure out how to go from just peacefully existing with your art as it is being, as you a right. being created it, and right. trying to be a part of the system that indicates that, well, whatever it is that you do well is what you should commodify. That's like capitalism. Oh, I hate it so much.
But, you know, I'm sure there's someone that's listening that's like, that's all fine and good, but how do we pay these bills?
Right, so, how did you get to that point?
So it really was a struggle between like the restlessness came in with regard to like, how am I spending my time? I'm discontent because I'm tired because I just stood up for 10 hours, you know, dishing up cappuccinos. Mm-hmm. At a coffee shop, and now, you know, am I gonna draw tonight or am I just gonna go to bed? You know, it's yeah. that kind of thing. That's the big struggle, that the path to being a creative is hard because there's that pressure to
feel like this is what is on the line for me. Whether or not this does well is the difference between me eating or not eating. If you put it all on that, or like you said, trying to stay in the traditional workforce, knowing that that is not what gives you ease and peace as a being. That conversation is something that I need to unpack in a whole separate episode, is this concept of being like the plants. They just are. They don't have to be trying to figure out, when am I supposed to bloom? Why this one blooming before me? And all that other stuff.
Yeah. And then as a Black person, we don't have the luxury to fail in those big ways like that.
No.
Like, it's not like, you know, I couldn't call my mom and be like, could you pay my rent? Because I was drawing a picture, you know.
Yeah, so the stakes are high.
You still have to figure out how to pay the rent.
So let me just read a little bit more about rich soil so we can get back into that, and a bit more about how you got to feel the way that you feel about your level of success currently. So I'm just reading in the description from your website, indicating there are life-size sculptures that have transformed the grounds of Hillwood, which was where you first did an installation. And these are in the gardens, and they are life-size, three-dimensional dancing wire sculptures, emerging, just ethereal is a word that I just added myself, that wasn't in there. But the description indicates that you are breathing life into wire, transforming an industrial product into fascinating and moving works of art, springing to life. It just in full display. And if you haven't seen it yet, then I will put the website in the episode notes so that you can figure out where currently it's being exhibited. But wow, so we're talking about like drawing and having a sketchbook and coming up and through college and not really feeling it, and having worked a variety of jobs, undoubtedly. That's very relatable to me. But how did you come to wire and decide this is the medium?
Wow. I did a lot of drawing. I did some sewing. I worked with beads for a while. I was working at this cafe and there was a bead store next door, and I just got hooked on all these little glass beads. I would make these dangly earrings out of them. I mean, I was spending so much money on beads that it was just like bills and beads, and there was not much left. And then at one point I was in a bead store because, you know, after going to this one store I'd always go to, then of course, if I saw a store anywhere else with beads, I'd go and look. And so I found the wire in one of these stores, and I thought I would experiment with making candle holders that had beads on them. And so I bought the wire, but as I played with the wire, I liked it better just by itself. And I liked the feel of it. And then I just had this daydream of the feel of the wire in my hands made me think of like drawing. But then I was like, I wish I could draw, you know. It was one of those weird, like, imaginary fantasy moments of like, I wish I could draw or capture some kind of movement with this wire and just freeze frame like a moment in time. And so that's really been what I've been doing for, you know, since then. And so
that's the aha moment. I love that.
Yeah. So it was, you know, I realized when I looked through some files that I had, all these magazine clippings of pictures, they were all photos of people like with the wind blowing against them, or they were running, or they had like, you know, air blowing in some way. So their clothes moved.
Yes.
And so I was like, if I could only make this, you know, out of wire, that would be cool, because it'd be like just freeze framing a moment. And
that's amazing.
So I just experimented with this wire, and, you know, the technique that I use, I taught myself. And it's this overlapping of hundreds upon hundreds of pieces of wire that are looped and hooked together. And I create sort of a shell of a person. And so if you were to see my work, particularly the garments, look as if there's a body within the garment.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just the garment, but it looks like there's someone inside, which is why I say breathing life into wire.
It's really cool. That's why I use the term ethereal, is because there is something that is evoked if you're looking at it and you get some kind of spiritual kind of connection there. And just to consider seeing these forms that are very clearly human forms that are like shells, and it's very much a metaphor or symbolism for our bodies being temporary. And I know as an artist that you are hyper aware of the way that life is temporary. And so it's just so cool how artists are able to capture something. And it's not that you do all the things, but what you do it is really cool in the way that it invokes thought.
Well, thank you. Yeah, with capturing a gesture, there's, I always have a fun time just listening to people talk when they look at it, you know, and it's fun for me to eavesdrop as opposed to like walking up to them and being like, hi, I'm the artist. Because I don't really want to hear I don't want to hear the flattery. I just want,
yeah,
I want to hear what they really think or how they're receiving whatever it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, to hear people look at something and they'll be like, you know, that's Aunt Cheryl right there. And they'll name,
wow,
you know, like based on the bodies, they'll name, you know, if that isn't Wanda, you know, and they'll just.
I love that. Your work has been displayed in public gardens. First and foremost, did you ever imagine that your art would be showcased in such a way? Was that something that was ever at the forefront of your mind?
Hey, Soil Cousins, tune in next week to hear the answer to this question and to learn more about Christine May's Rich Soil exhibit and how it is currently traveling the country, and more about her story.
At the time that we spoke, her exhibit was still at Atlanta Botanical Garden. Make sure you tune in next week to hear the second part of Christine's story, and we will see you next time, or hear from you. You'll hear from me next time on Black in the Garden. Love, Light, and Soil.